Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula Gordon. Our guest believes there's a spirit of history. He says it leads ordinary people to do extraordinary things, to move humankind forward. Our guest is John Lewis, one of the most courageous leaders of America's civil rights movement, and now he's a congressman. John Lewis grew up poor in rural Alabama. While still a teenager, he put his life on the line over and over in nonviolent sit-ins and freedom rides in Mississippi prisons, and perhaps most memorably, on the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. John Lewis believes the spirit of history called him and calls us all to overcome our fears, to accept each other in spite of our differences.
I think that's what it's all about, and I believe we can and must make that great leap. And sometimes you step out there. Sometimes you don't know where it's going to lead because you don't have a blueprint or roadmap, but you go anyway. You step out on faith. You keep moving. Keep moving your feet. And you take others with you as you move. And I think that's where we're going as a nation, as a people, as a world community.
John Lewis has represented Georgia's 5th District in the United States House of Representatives since 1987. He now exerts the same leadership in Congress that made him a powerful force during nonviolent civil rights sit-ins in the late 1950s and early 60s, as president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, during the March on Washington in 1963, and when he led the Selma March that culminated in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. John Lewis calls his memoir of his years in the movement, Walking with the Wind. He joined Bill Russell and me at the Commerce Club in Atlanta to talk about where we've been and where we are going. Congressman John Lewis, we talk lots on this show about living in a time of great change. And I usually think of that in terms of technology. I think about all the stuff that speeds things up and the computers and all. But as I read your book, I had a renewed sense that the time of great change in which we live is driven by great ideas. You've lived some of those great ideas. Does it feel that way to you? Do you feel like you've been in the midst of a time where great ideas just took hold of you and took you forth?
I feel very much like I lived during a period when I have been more than lucky, but really blessed to be picked up, lifted up, by what I like to call the spirit of history.
The spirit of history. Now, is that like a religious sense for
Well,
you?
For those of us who might be religious, it could be religious. But I think it is something just maybe in the universe that tend to track one down and say, you must act, you must stand. So you don't have many resources. You don't have any money. You don't have the new technology like we didn't have it back then, but you have your being, you have your bodies, and you must use your bodies as living witness to the truth.
You talk a lot about the spirit of history, and that's a very important idea. It makes me wonder where the spirit of history is today. What's it doing? Where is the spirit?
I would like to think that the spirit of history is still moving. That it is still bringing people together to create what some of us used to call, and I still call, the beloved community. The idea of a war community at peace with itself.
One of the great ideas that it seemed to me was emerging in the course of you telling the story of your life is that people can get along, people who are different from each other. Now, this is not such a new idea. This is an ancient idea, but we seem to regularly lose track of that. Isn't that fairly fundamental to what the spirit of history is helping nudge us toward, that people who are different can get along?
I believe that it is so basic. It is so in keeping with that spirit, with that concept, that we can get along, that we can live together. During those early years, I had an opportunity to study the great religions of the world, to study the philosophy of love and nonviolence, to study what Gandhi attempted to do in South Africa, what he did and accomplished in India, to study Thoreau and civil disobedience. This whole idea of moving toward community, not chaos, not conflict, but community.
Over and over again, as you told your story, you talked about the things the times in which you did not feel fear. It is really striking to me that you have lived through some of the most violent times that America has experienced at home. And yet, over and over again, the fear that is endemic to the species did not own you. How did that come to be?
Well, as a human being and as a person, you come to that point where you lose that sense of fear. When I was growing up in rural Alabama during the 40s and the 50s, my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, my great-grandparents would tell me, don't get in trouble. Don't get in trouble. Don't get arrested. Don't go to jail. It's bad. It's not good. And the first time I got arrested, I felt free.
Free?
I felt liberated. I felt like I had crossed over. And I lost that sense of fear. I said, if I can get arrested and go to jail, there's nothing left for me to fear.
Our guest is Congressman John Lewis, who has been in the midst of the great movements of America for all of his life, starting since 1940. He is our guest on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is with me here at the Commerce Club with guests, and we're going to be back in just a moment. We hope that you will be, too. Welcome back. This is The Paula Gordon Show, and I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is with me here with Congressman John Lewis at the Commerce Club. Bill Russell, you said you had a question. It's hard for me, but I'll let you ask
it. Part of this sounds like, from the outside, it looks like overcoming fear of the unknown. That we tend to sit around and create monsters, and sometimes the monsters are very real, and sometimes the monsters are imaginary, but always when we come eyeball to eyeball, they're not the same as what we anticipate. Is that part of what was going on?
Bill, I think you're so right that there is a tendency on the part of us all as human beings to fear what we do not know. And sometime in life, you have to come face to face with reality. I remember at the bridge in Selma in 1965, we were marching peacefully, silent protests across the Alabama River. And we were set on by policemen on horseback, billy clubs, and bullwhips. I thought I was going to die. I saw death, I believe, and I stared it down. I lost my fear of dying. You come to that point where you see something so basic, so right, so fair, and so just that death cannot frighten you.
That is a powerful freedom, isn't it? Hadn't that freed you up to do everything since?
Well, I take everything since then for me, I almost have been like cakewalk.
But after facing down hundreds of mounted police on the Selma highway,
it does make
highway,
a political campaign a little more manageable,
well,
doesn't it?
Sometimes I feel like saying to my colleagues, I feel like saying,
your colleagues
I've been
in the United States in the House of Representatives.
I feel like saying, I've been there. I've seen that. I've done that.
Yeah. To be able to come to that sense of peace. I had a sense as I was reading through your remarkable life, almost as if you were in the eye of a hurricane, the deep quiet that you were able to project. And even in your telling of the story, I could feel this sense of just centeredness with the world going around you in violent ways. And yet when it was past, there was rather like after a hurricane or a tornado, it was clear. There was room to grow again. Did it feel that way when you were doing it?
Well, the book started off talking about a windstorm. And as a child, a young child, we were caught in a windstorm in a house. My first cousins, my younger brothers and sisters, my aunt, and the rain came down, there was thunder and lightning, and my aunt was frightened. My mother used to say over and over again, when there's lightning and thunder, we should be quiet because God is doing his work. And we were frightened because of the lightning, the thunder, and the wind. And it seemed like the house was going to lift, and we would walk to that corner to try to hold down the house. These little bodies trying to hold down the house.
Little bitty kids.
Little kids. 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, but I can remember my aunt having the 15 of us by the hand, walking from one corner of the house to the other. the rain coming down on the tin top. But it's just like being in America, the American house. Every now and then, seem like the house is going to lift, that it's going to tear apart. But over and over again, black and white, all of us been coming together to hold American house down, to hold it together.
Isn't that the world's story, too?
It's the story of the world, because we must find a way to end the conflict, to end the violence, to end the division, and create a world house, a world community at peace with itself.
You're talking about, I'm sorry, Bill, I've got to finish this thought, the big forces of nature, when you talk about the winds and the storms and the calm. This ability of this our species to get along is part of that big force, isn't it?
It is important. You know, Martin Luther King Jr., my friend and hero, used to say from time to time that we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we will perish as fools.
As fools?
As fools. And in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the organization that I headed, better known as SNCC, we used to call ourselves a circle of trust, a band of brothers and sisters. And that's what I think we all must look and strive for on this planet.
Lonnie Guinier talks about, and then I remember it because I just seen it, her articulation, about the absolute essential importance of a faith story and a church in terms of bringing people together and moving forward.
And she's not talking
she's
about
not,
religion either.
Well, not necessarily, but is that a reasonable articulation of what you experienced then and are trying to create now?
Well, I think there is something that out there that we all are striving and searching to create. And we have to bring people together to create this sense of community, not just the American community, but the world community. I see my involvement as an extension of my faith. You have to make it real. You have to bring it alive. You just can't talk about it. You have to live it. I used to think that the only true integration and real integration that existed in America was within the movement itself, because you had young blacks and young whites struggling together, going to jail together, dying together. Become part of your family. You become like brothers and sisters. Become part of your extended family. And on this little planet, we must learn to live together.
And somebody's got to practice it first to show the rest of us how to do it.
Someone must have the courage, must be courageous enough, must be daring enough, must have raw courage to get out there and say, this is what we're going to do. I've said from time to time that maybe in America, we all came here in different ships, but now we're all in the same boat. But if you look at it, we all, as human beings, we're all part of the same family.
You talk about courage. Over and over again, as you tell the story in your own voice about what America has come through in the last 50 years and in some ways 400 years on different boats in the same boat, it's hard to find courage. And it's particularly hard to find courage if you're not on the Pettus Bridge in Selma facing mounted police. This sense of courage, of facing the hard issues, how do we do that when we don't have a focal point of bad guys?
You know, when I stood on the bridge in 65, I was on the Freedom Ride in 61, I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. I went thinking about trying to perform a courageous act. I saw something that I felt was wrong. And I think in our world today, when we see wrong, we should try to right it.
Whatever it is?
Whatever it is, we should speak out. When we see a problem, we shouldn't try to hide it under the rug. We should bring it out from under the rug and deal with it. We should confront violence. We should confront racism and bigotry. We should be a little more tolerant as people, as human beings. And sometimes you just do it. Just do it because it's the right thing to do.
Courage does not necessarily require a bad guy, does it? It can be a, you know, an act. It can be a more positive. I mean, you can be working towards something and not have to demonize anybody. I mean, it can take courage to not be in the mainstream.
I think you're so right. You don't necessarily need a bad guy. You don't need a bull kind of a Chef Clark in Selma, a state troopers in Selma. To have courage. And I think in our society today, in the world community, we spend too much time demonizing others, trying to tear someone down, rather than to build, rather than to reconcile. We try to divide. So we need reconciliation. We need to build up people.
You talk about, and I want to come back after a break to talk more about the nonviolent movement itself, as not having losers. And maybe that's where we should be when we come back. We're talking with Congressman John Lewis. Bill Russell and I are with him and others at the Commerce Club. Please stay with us. Congressman John Lewis is our guest on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are here with him and others at the Commerce Club. One of the big ideas that you helped me think more about was the Gandhian idea, and it is not irrelevant that this idea has been brewing throughout history but came back to us through India, a radically different culture. The idea of nonviolence, of taking, but it's not just nonviolence, it's nonviolent action. I was very struck that one of the things you made incredibly clear was that it was very important not to have losers. That everybody needed to win, that it might, you might need to retreat, but neither you as the actors nor the people that you were helping to change in their lives, that nobody needed to lose. Isn't that part of what you and Bill were talking about, not needing to demonize people?
Well, it is important to give every human being a great sense of self-worth. If you accept the idea that in every human being, there is a spark of divinity.
Call it what you will.
Call it what you may. For me, I say it's a spark of the divine. That you have to say, simply because a guy is bad or mean, whether it's a Bull Connor or a Sheriff Clark, he's a human being. And we were not out to destroy any person. We were out to redeem, to win over. Because we saw these individuals as victims of customs, tradition, and an evil system called segregation and racial discrimination. So we were not out to demean anyone. And today, I think it's much more freeing and liberating to see some of these individuals that now have changed and walking a different path with different attitudes. Because you accept nonviolence not simply as a technique or as a tactic, but as a way of life, as a way of living. So it's not just not hitting someone back or striking back, but it's also attitude. It's the way you think.
You talk about it being a place, that there is a sense of centeredness, that it's almost physical once one has really understood this concept of not engaging in violence, of not succumbing to the fears that are so human. It's almost a physical feeling that you go to this place where you can be unfearful, that you can be peaceful. Does it feel that way inside of you? John Lewis, of all people in the world, you have faced more fear and more violence than any of the rest of us will ever see. But I have a sense that there is a place in you to which you go that is this nonviolent idea.
Well, Paula, someplace along the way, I don't know where, I made up my mind not to become bitter, not to become hostile. And many of my colleagues asked me from time to time, are you hostile? Or don't you feel strange towards some of the people who did what they... I feel so at peace with myself. I don't have malice or ill feeling toward a single human being. I may not like something that is the truth. I may not like some of the things that some people say. And I can stand up and come across with a sense of righteous indignation. And sometimes people say, you don't smile enough. It doesn't mean that I'm mad. It doesn't mean that I'm angry. I'm just thinking.
reconciliation and redemption. You are a congressman. And those are not
some
words.
People say that.
You are my congressman.
Those words do not just sort of roll off the tongue when people are typically describing Congress. And increasingly there is a sense that, that Congress has become more unforgiving, irredeemable. The politics that is electoral politics and what Congress needs to be doing and what you're trying to do, how do you bring that together? How can one person influence an institution?
In the Congress today, several of us, Democrats and Republicans, conservative and liberals, been getting together over a meal in our home, in a little office, in a little hideaway, and been talking about the issue of race. I've been going to some of the most conservative places in America, crossing the aisle to meet with some of my colleagues. We may vote different, but I went out to Michigan, I went down to Savannah, and in a few days I'm going to two or three other parts of the country. I think it's important to help educate, to help sensitize, and for us to get to know each other better, to deal with the question of race, to bring people together.
Isn't that what you've been doing all your life?
Well, it is what I've been doing, and I think I can do it now on another level. It's not a piece of legislation that we can pass, but it's discussion. It is dialogue. It is reconciling people to each other.
It's engagement, isn't it? I mean, you've got it's living
engagement,
with people.
And it's very much in keeping with the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence, really.
Say more. Tie those together.
Well.
And remember, we're talking about Congress.
I asked that to some of my younger colleagues in the Congress when they become so strident on certain issues. I said, you're too young. You don't understand. Come and
John
walk in my
Lewis.
Shoes.
Do you really?
I really said. I
lectured them. You're the one who is among those young ones who changed America, and you're saying they're too young.
Yeah, I said they don't. Many young people today have no sense of contemporary history. They don't know and understand what people did by working and building together. And I said, come, spend some time here. Watch this, read this.
It's very important to talk about the young because, as you reminded us yet again, it is the young who carry our future. It's also the young who changed our past. And perhaps that will continue to happen in Congress, but when you and your colleagues, who eventually formed the organization of SNCC, but you and your colleagues, both the older ones whom you were challenging and the younger ones of whom you were surely a leader, the very energy and the unconnectedness of your youth had to be an advantage. Where are our young ones now?
Well, I said from time to time that young people are too quiet. They're just too quiet. They're too passive. And I don't mean in a bad sense of the word. They need to make some noise. You know, there's nothing wrong with agitating for the right thing. Saying and demanding of the country that we do more in education, spend more money on education, not more money on missiles and bombs and guns. We have enough bombs and missiles to destroy this planet more than once. So we, young people should be up in arms. Let's save the planet. Let's clean up the environment. People have a right to know what is in the water they drink, what is in the food we eat, what is in the air we breathe. Let young people rise up and say something about health care. Looking out for our senior citizen, looking out for the needy, for the disabled. I just think as we move toward the 21st century, people in America, and especially the young, are too quiet. We had time on our hand.
Yeah,
we didn't
really?
We didn't have responsibility. We didn't have a mortgage. No. We didn't have to pay rent. And we were free. We went off to get an education. But we not only got an education in the classroom, received an education in the streets. And some of us were forced to grow up. I grew up sitting in at a lunch counter. I grew
you
up standing
You mean literally.
In. I literally grew up when someone walked by and put a mic in my face and said, why are you sitting in? I had to respond. Why are you marching for the right to vote? I had to respond.
And the answer was?
I had to say, because it's not in what is going on, it's not in keeping with my faith. It's not in keeping with the Bill of Rights. It's not in keeping with the Declaration of Independence. It's not in keeping with the Constitution. And that's why we are here, to enhance the dignity of humankind.
And you can you are continuing to do that. I'm hearing a consistency that's subtle. You've always been more active than rhetorical. You would rather do things than talk about them.
Well, you
is
know,
that right?
I think that is very much the case. You know, we had this old saying, you got to do more than talk the talk. You got to walk the walk.
Yeah.
And that we have people that are very good talkers, they're very good speakers, but when it comes down to
the job,
rolling up the sleeves and doing the work, many run the other way.
What makes me think of that is you're talking about these little meetings that you're having around the country with your colleagues in Congress, and the rhetorical view, the public view, the media presentation, which tends to reflect the rhetoric, makes it look terrible. And what you're saying is there is work being done behind the scenes that is not rhetorical, but dealing with just little pieces, one person at a time, one issue at a time. This sounds optimistic.
In recent days, I've gone out to places and set up meetings, bringing people together, getting people to talk, to speak to each other, who live in different parts of a city, or maybe where two cities are right together and divided by a river. And sometimes people will never cross that river, cross that bridge. So one thing that I've been about during the past few years is to build bridges of understanding, bridges of reconciliation, and I think that's what we must continue to do.
If there is any person in America alive whose very life testifies to the importance of action, it is John Lewis, who is our congressman in the 5th District in Atlanta. We're going to continue this conversation with Congressman John Lewis, whose stunning book, Walking with the Wind, tells the story of his life. Bill Russell and I are with him at the Commerce Club with invited guests, and we're going to be back shortly. There's a great deal more to be said. Congressman John Lewis is our guest. I am Paula Gordon, and Bill Russell is with me here at the Commerce Club. This business about action, there is a wonderful story that you tell in your book, Walking with the Wind, about having to come to a moment in Nashville when you are still very young. I don't think you're 21 yet, and you're being challenged on all fronts, and all you will say to these people is, we're gonna walk. I had the sense that was the mantra for your life. We're gonna walk. Isn't that what we all must do? Isn't this the action part of being alive, that we all must walk?
Well, near the end of the book, I cite an African proverb which says something like, when you pray, move your feet. I don't necessarily mean that you bow your head and clap your hand. Sometimes we pray, all of us pray in different ways. But if you believe in it, if you believe in something, you should show some sign. And people have said to us, if we march on this day, if we walk on this day, we will be beaten. The local police officer will allow some people to come in and beat us.
Brutally.
And they were right. I kept saying, we cannot let violence stop nonviolence. We will walk. And we did walk on that day and took seats at a lunch counter. And young people came in. They did beat us. They poured hot coffees down on our head, put lighted cigarettes out in our hair and down our backs. And we all were arrested and went to jail. But we were able to demonstrate that violence would not stop nonviolence.
I think it is hard for some people to remember because you can't stomach it, and many haven't experienced it, the reign of terror that existed in America before the movement moved us to a better place in this country. Do we have any... How do we keep alive that sense of the progress we have made while not getting angry and buried in the past, but making this part of our future? Say, oh, we learned from that.
Well, this is what I'm hoping that the book would do in part, to say, yes, we've come a distance. We've made a lot of progress, and we have. I think there's a greater sense of hope, there's a greater sense of optimism in this region, in the American South, than any other part of the country. Because we had the capacity and the ability, with the leadership of Dr. King and other, to bring the problem out into the open, and we've dealt with it. And as Southerners, black or white, we don't want to go back. We want to continue to move forward.
We've sort of done the work of America here, haven't we?
I think in a real sense, just maybe, we have saved America. You know, America could have been, the American South could have been like Bosnia, Northern Ireland, Lebanon, or some other part of the world. But we are in the process, as we move toward the 21st century, I think, I may be too hopeful, I may be too optimistic, but I don't think so. I think we are in the process of laying down the bread on the race. And this part of our country may emerge, just maybe, as a model for the rest of the world.
Well, because racism is a subject in the whole world.
It is a...
It's not just the American South that's dealing with
it. It's not just America. But if we make it work, this diversity, this sense of community, work here in America, maybe, just maybe, we can say to the rest of the world, we've been able to do it. I think we're going to do it. I think we must do it. We don't have any alternative but to do it.
That's right.
Can we talk a little bit about leadership? Your views of leadership are not textbook views of leadership necessarily. And I'm thinking specifically about the wonderful scene in Washington, the march, where the leaders showed up late for the parade, essentially. Or the parade started without them. You weren't late.
This is the Great March on Washington in 1963.
And all the pictures show the leaders, but what had happened is the photographers cleared enough space that we could see the leaders leading. But what happened then, apparently, is that the crowd opened up and in some ways transported you to the front, which to me is just a wonderful metaphor of what I think your view of leadership is.
Well, my view of a leadership, I think true leadership must emerge. It's not necessarily appointed. It is not necessarily elected. It sort of emerged out of a situation, out of an effort, out of a movement. We had been up on Capitol Hill on that day, August 28, 1963, visiting with members of the Congress, congressional leadership, and we came down from the hill, the group of 10 of us. The march was already gone. People were already walking by the hundreds, by the thousands. And it was like, there go my people. Let me catch up with them. It was the photographers who sort of got in there, and they created this openness, really, sort of had people to wait, let them get in here. These are the leaders. And so we just got in there and caught hand. And so all around America, you saw these unbelievable photographs. And I had one in my office today and make it appear that we were leading them. We were really following.
And doesn't that speak to how the great movements happen?
I think great movements, really, the people get out there. They get out front.
Plain people.
Plain, ordinary people just get out front. And that's what we had. Just, this is what the book is all about. Simple, ordinary people doing extraordinary things with their lives. Not with a lot of resources. Just using what they had.
I'm a great believer, this is going to sound really old-fashioned, so forgive me. I really am a great believer in homework. You'd done your homework. The leaders, the nominal leaders and the real leaders, there's a sense of discipline. The work that you had done before as students in Nashville, before you made that first sit-in, before you did the first stand-in, before you did the first Freedom Ride, you had done the work. You didn't just wake up one day and say, oh, let's go have a sit-in. Isn't that homework really important, that grounding?
We were more than lucky. We were really blessed. We had a wonderful young teacher, a young minister by the name of Jim Lawson, who had traveled to India, studied Gandhi, and he came back, and every Tuesday night, a young group of students would go down and study the philosophy of nonviolence. Every Tuesday night, like it was a requirement, like it was an obligation. And there were students at all of the colleges and universities in Nashville. And we studied for almost the entire school year before we had the first test sit-in. It was so important. We did role playing. We had drama. Blacks playing the role of whites and whites playing the role of blacks. And then we would have a biracial group playing different roles to prepare us for the first sit-in. And we became grounded. Dr. King used to come to Nashville from time to time during those days, and he would say the students in Nashville have the best understanding of the philosophy of nonviolence than anyone he knew. And it was because of this young minister, this young man named Jim Lawson. It is important to do your homework. It is important to be prepared, to be disciplined.
The very fact that you were role-playing and putting yourself in the shoes of the people who would become your abusers, did that help? Did that give you a different sense of what you were doing, that you too had to play the role of the fear and anger that others were going to be projecting toward you?
I think this did so much to put us in the shoes of the opposition. For someone to come up to you and say, you cannot be here, you cannot sit here, you cannot go in here, and then for you to turn around and be placed in a position of saying to someone, because maybe they're short, or maybe their hair's a different color, or maybe because they're not attending the right school. And so you could discriminate against people for different reasons. And we came to the conclusion, really, these categories are silly, and that we shouldn't discriminate against anyone. And trying to convince ourselves that the opposition is human, that they have feelings, they have attitudes, and we're here to change feelings and attitudes and behavior.
Don't we still have something to learn about that? If we were walking in the shoes of a young so-called welfare mother, wouldn't we see the world differently than just standing afar and casting aspersions? If we were to, the old phrase, walk in the other guy's shoes today with today's challenges, isn't there still something to be learned from that sharing of experience?
I think there's a great deal to be learned from the sharing of experiences. I think that what was so beautiful about individuals like Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. You know, Bobby Kennedy had the capacity, the ability to take off his tie, pull off his coat, and loosen up. And he would go down to the Delta, Mississippi, and spend time with a poor black family with little children. He would go to Appalachian, spend time with poor whites, or go to the Southwest, to the barrios, and spend time with Mexican American, or go to a reservation. And I think he grew and he learned, and I think we all can grow and learn by putting ourselves in the places of others. In a sense, forgetting about our own circumstances and getting involved in the circumstances of others.
We're going to be back in just a moment with Congressman John Lewis. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be here with Congressman Lewis at the Commerce Club. We will be back. Please do stay with us. Welcome back. I am Paula Gordon, Bill Russell, and I are talking with Congressman John Lewis. A great deal of your life is important because of where you've been and your past and the story you have to tell about America. An equally important part of your life is where we are and where we are going. You tell a wonderful story about visiting with your friend Bernard Lafayette, who after 30 years has gone back to lead the college, which you both attended in Nashville when you were very young. And you have this touching moment when you say, I don't know if I could do that. That is really hard, what Bernard Lafayette is doing now, leading a small college against great challenges, and he's not in the spotlight, and he's... That's a really remarkable statement to me, that I don't know if I, John Lewis, who as far as I'm concerned has hung the moon and probably could do it again, that what Bernard Lafayette is doing is hard.
It is very hard. I think it's very difficult.
Harder than when you two were standing up to the physical abuses we had to see to change America?
I think it was easier to march, to sit in, to go on the freedom ride, to face the billy clubs, the bull whips, the tear gas, then to go out and every day, day in and day out, you don't know whether you're going to get the next grant from, to beg for money, to support a small college. It's hard and difficult to be a college president. I see college presidents, school administrators come in my office almost every day saying, help us, we need this, we need that. It is tough.
So we don't necessarily have to do the hard work by being out in the physical spaces. There's hard work to be done everywhere?
There's very difficult work to be done everywhere. One group of people, I don't think we said thanks to enough, public school teachers. Sometimes I say every public school teacher should be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize just for maintaining order and discipline. We should say thank you. We don't say thank you to law enforcement people. Each time they put on a uniform and step out, they're taking a great risk. It's hard work. Rearing a family. I don't understand how my mother and father made it. I don't understand it.
Well, and it's worth my asking. Your mother and father, as you described your childhood in the rural South Alabama, it could have been any time in the last 3,000 years in any farming community, agricultural community, where people were just barely getting by.
Any place. Any place in America, or maybe any place in the world. And you see people that still problems all over the world, not just in America, where people are struggling day in and day out just to survive, just to make it. I don't understand it. And too many people today said, we don't have this, we don't have that. And my mother kept saying, make do. We have to make do.
Your mother also treated work as a sacrament, you say.
Yeah. She said over and over again, hard work never killed anyone. I sometimes wanted to debate her on that question.
It was the part about picking cotton, wasn't
it? It was the hoeing.
The chopping.
Chopping cotton and pulling corn and shaking peanut. It was not easy. But she kept saying, work, that you got to work for what you get. Work.
I'd like to go back to the spirit of, or maybe forward to the spirit of history. And the notion of preparation, it seems there was a curious confluence of events that occurred in the late 50s and early 60s. Gandhi's influence, Jim Lawson runs into Martin Luther King at Oberlin College, comes to Nashville, David Halberstam happens to be in Nashville, some kids in Greensboro behave badly. I mean, you can't script this.
So much but, for strategic plan.
But you can be prepared to exploit it. This whole, the movement, sort of ran out in the late 60s. 1968 was a terrible year. And I think a lot of people would like to recreate the feel of that. But also, I think a lot of people have a sense that there is a need for that. Can we force it? Or is the best we can do just be prepared?
I don't think we can force it. I think we can be prepared. I think we must be prepared for the moment. But you never know. You never know. We're in that moment. And some people call it, you know, lightning striking. No, I believe the spirit of history will strike somebody down or some group down at the right moment, at the right time. No one selected Rosa Parks. No one selected the city of Selma. Maybe Selma selected itself. And I think we have to be prepared.
Yeah, and when the spirit shows up, you don't say, come back next week?
No.
Not an option?
You cannot say that. There's an old song that we used to sing. I'm going to do what the spirit said do. If the spirit said march, I'm going to march. If the spirit said walk, I'm going to walk. If the spirit said sit in, I'm going to sit in. I'm going to be guided by the spirit.
And what must we be doing now to be prepared for this?
I think we have to prepare. We have to be prepared as individuals. But we have to be prepared as a community, as a people, as a nation, as a world community. The time must come. All across this planet we call spaceship Earth, when we have the courage to say enough is enough, that somehow in some way we're going to be a little more humane. We're going to be a little more peaceful. We're going to share our resources with the rest of the world. It makes me very sad when I see us spend more money, more of our limited resources, on more bombs, more missiles, and more guns. When there's hungry, when there's poverty, when there's disease, that we can use these resources to help do away with hunger and poverty and heal some of the ills of humankind.
There's another resource. We tend to think of ethnic differences, racial differences, as a challenge, as a problem. And it would seem to me that it is also a resource, that having access to people who do not see the world exactly as I see it can have utility. And they don't necessarily have to be a different color. They can be a different gender. They can be from a different country. They can be from a different culture. They can go to a different church. But that, that there is an opportunity that is available in the discussion that tends to want to center around race. And rather than deploring it...
Well, we shouldn't be afraid of diversity. We shouldn't fear. We should embrace diversity. We should embrace humanity. We should embrace... I've had an opportunity. I've been very lucky, but more than lucky, I've been very blessed as a congressperson, as a participant in the civil rights movement, provided me with the opportunity to travel and see the rest of the world, to Europe. I've gone into the Kremlin long ago and had an opportunity to meet with members of the Supreme Soviet, to South Africa before it was free and independent, to talk and meet with different factions and other parts of the world. And when you really look at it, we all are one. We all are the same. And it shouldn't be that difficult.
I have the sense that we allow our experience to be mediated by television, by newspapers, radio. what I'm hearing you say is that there's something to be said for just getting out and mixing it up with people who are not just like us.
It is very important to get out there and mix it up, to get out and travel.
And it's okay to disagree.
Disagree. You can, you
but
know,
engage.
In a family, you disagree. But you don't run off. You don't create chaos. You try to create community. You reconcile the differences. We should be engaged. We don't withdraw and say we're going to leave the planet. We're not going any place. This is the only one we know.
And even if we did have that spigot for an exit, the embracing those differences, the celebrating even those differences.
That's a better way to put it. Celebration. Celebrating the differences. Celebrating diversity. I think it makes us all better people, better human beings.
I don't want to go away from this thought without talking about the fact that over and again, you turn to song, you turn to laughter in the movement. This wasn't all just grim, that there was joy in this as well as pain and suffering. Is that right?
We did sing a great deal, but I cannot carry a tune.
We
did sing a great deal.
That doesn't seem to matter, does it?
No, but because I went along, I tried to sing, and I had the ability to hum a little.
Isn't there joy in this?
There's a lot of joy. It's a lot of joy, and it created a sense of solidarity and a sense of power. When you heard people singing, people lifting their voices, it was great, unbelievable. If you're in a small church or a hall, if you're walking down the street and people just singing to the top of their voices, it was power. And it helped to free you. And I think for a lot of people, it helped to get them past that particular action, get them past maybe their sense of fear and misgiving.
This is Congressman John Lewis, who, among other things, helped change America before and is changing America now in the United States House of Representatives. Bill Russell and I are talking with him at the Commerce Club. We're going to be back in just a moment for a few more minutes with Congressman Lewis. Please do stay tuned. We are back for a couple more minutes with Congressman John Lewis, Bill Russell and I. Bill Russell is lurking over there wanting to say something.
We were talking about diversity, and diversity scares a lot of people. I'm sitting here thinking, this sounds good in the abstract to a lot of folks, but a lot of people say, you know, basically I'm not comfortable with people, and I think... People who are not like me, people who don't see things the way I do, and I think the operant word, and you've already covered it, is fear. They're afraid. And the point is to get past the fear, and the way to get past the fear is to engage.
Is
because
that right?
I think you must engage in order to overcome fear. I think we said earlier that we fear the unknown, what we do not know. Don't be afraid. Get to know people of a different race, color, different gender.
I had a sense when I was thinking about this wonderful opportunity to talk to you, I was trying to get a sense of what's the big picture here? What's John Lewis's life about? And I am not presumptuous enough to say that I have the answer, but an answer for me was this idea that ideas do have a life of their own and they do carry us forward. And the idea that kept coming back to me is that we as a species can make the next step past the fear, past the only clinging to ourselves, and go over to a place where we can accept people who are not like us and keep those feet moving to an unknowable future. Is that part of what We're Gonna Walk was about?
I think you said it better than I can say it.
Oh, no, John Lewis.
Oh, yes, I think I
said
it much better.
No, you've lived it, John Lewis. That was just words from me.
No, I think that's what it's all about. And I believe we can and must make that great leap. And sometimes you step out there. Sometimes you don't know where it's going to lead because you don't have a blueprint or roadmap, but you go anyway. You step out on faith. You keep moving. Keep moving your feet. And you take others with you as you move. And I think that's where we're going as a nation, as a people, as a world community.
A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a decision to make the journey. Then. And it doesn't begin with magically appearing at the destination. And a lot of the challenge is to decide to make the journey. That's what you did in Nashville. Actually, that's what you did in Pike County, Alabama, wasn't it? You just didn't know quite what
the journey was going to be.
But it's been a journey.
Yeah.
And it's an ongoing journey.
Right.
I didn't know. I knew I wanted to make the journey. This may sound sort of strange, but when I was very, very young, I remember on that farm that I grew up on, a cousin of mine, we wanted to get out of Alabama. And we had this dream as young kids. We were going to slow down. This was not in keeping with the environment these days. We were going to slow down this huge pine tree. And somehow out of this pine tree, we were going to make a bus and going to get the big part of the tree and make wheels. And we were going to roll out of Alabama. So I think I've been on a journey for some time. It's been a great journey, and I want to continue on this journey.
I hadn't really thought of the irony that, you know, 15 years later, more or less, you were on a bus. It was not a pine tree bus, but you were headed back
to where you came from. Burn. You talk about the power of nonviolence, the philosophy of nonviolence as being the way, which in other cultures is sometimes known as the Tao, that is part of a journey. Is that a journey we must all take?
I think we must take that journey as members of the human family, the journey of reconciliation, the journey of nonviolence. It's a more excellent way. It's a better way. You have to come to that point where you accept it as a way of life, as a way of living. Because if you only accept nonviolence as a technique or as a tactic, it becomes like a faucet. You can turn it on, you can turn it off. You have to decide whether I'm going to love today and hate tomorrow, whether I'm going to love Mary and hate Susie, whether I'm going to love John and hate Peter. Love is a better way. It is a more excellent way. The way of nonviolence is the way. I think, for me, it is one of those immutable principles that we cannot and must not deviate from.
We are all going to take the journey. It's a question of whether we do it with our eyes open or closed. It's whether we do it as passengers or participants. I mean, this is not optional.
We all must be participants. We cannot afford to sit on the sideline. We cannot. It's not a free ride. We all have to be participants.
No one in the 20th century has been more of a participant than John Lewis, for whom we offer our thanks, our gratitude, and don't quit. Still more work to be done.
Thank you. I will continue to make the journey. I will continue to walk with the wind.
We are all indebted to John Lewis for a lifetime of leading us beyond our individual fears. We also thank those who gathered with us at the Commerce Club and the club itself. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.